and once the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah while the ark was a-preparing, wherein few, that is, 8 souls, were saved by water. The like figure whereunto even baptism doth also now save us. Not the putting away of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience toward God, by the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who is gone into heaven and is on the right hand of God, angels and authorities and powers being made subject unto him.
For the sake of your soul, which is in the gravest danger.
Drive the money changers from the temple!
Only Christ exists. Only Christ. And I am not worth 45 or even 5 euros. I am worth nothing.
By all that you hold dear on this good earth, I bid you stand!
You're listening to Men with Chests, a Catholic podcast. Any opinions you hear are not necessarily shared by any other host on the show, the guest, our respective bishops, the Roman Curia, the Pope, or even King Jesus Christ himself. We are not canon lawyers, official church theologians, or ordained clergy. We're simply a ragtag cadre of Catholic laymen trying our best. We're Catholic in that we willingly assent our minds and souls to the full teaching authority of the magisterium of the Catholic Church in full communion with the Holy Father in Rome. We have chests in that we aspire to face down the inherent nihilism of modernity with full courage and manly faith in the truth of God's one holy Catholic and apostolic Church. Thank you for tuning in. Gentlemen, let us pray.
In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Ave Maria, gratia plena, Dominus tecum. Benedicta tu in mulieribus, et benedictus fructus ventris tui, Jesus. Sancta Maria, Mater Dei, ora pro nobis. Peccatoribus, nunc et in hora mortis nostra. Amen.
Amen. Saint Michael, the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our defense against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray, and do thou, O Prince of the heavenly hosts, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all the evil spirits who prowl about the world, seeking the ruin of souls. Amen.
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 In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Well, a hearty
Deus Vult!
Get a Deus Vult in there, Sean?
I did not. I will add mine. Deus Vult!
Perfect. Love it. All right, guys. How's it going?
It's going fairly well.
Wonderful. Lenten blessed.
I am getting over a cold, but I am sufficiently over that cold to join tonight. So I guess doing all right.
Good. Good. Did you have a good Ash Wednesday? I had a good Ash Wednesday. I had to work, unfortunately, but it was...
Yes, I had to work also. Worked...
I wish I had work to do.
I actually... My work schedule meant I had... my work schedule had to the 9 a.m. Mass, Ash Wednesday service, which was the most convenient one at that point, which was also the one Catholic school sends everyone to. So it was like a lot of school children and a few adults. So it was a little odd, but you know.
Okay.
Same idea.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, we, our parish has a school, so we have those masses with tons of kids sometimes.
Okay, gentlemen. Well, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. Let's see here. Well, let's talk about Lent. Do you guys want to discuss, I don't know, your Lenten, what you've given up? Just as a way to encourage the listeners here, or if you don't want to be specific, you can kind of talk about how you approach this season.
Well, I, as with, actually everyone, I guess, Sam and James and myself, I, did not grow up Catholic, but converted. And so, and you know, I was from, you know, the churches I had grown up with were definitely on the more, informal, side of the spectrum. And so I actually didn't grow up with Lent and, you know, the idea of let something go for that season. And so I'm really bad at coming up with things. I don't really have, I last year, I actually, tried, I actually did, give, I did, what was it? Basically, the Ari online was what I cut out. And I regret that I didn't entirely cut it out, but I definitely significantly cut it down. I don't know. Maybe I'll come up soon.
Good.
Good.
With me, it was more just giving up time. I tend to spend a lot more time usually, you know, doing things I want to do. Oftentimes that ends up being arguing on Facebook, but giving up a few hours each day to devote to prayer, study, devotionals. So that's what I've been doing. Also, side note, having a pregnant wife makes fasting very interesting, especially when her cravings consist of Bojangles and pizza.
Well, you can't fault her for that. I mean, pizza are both delicious. So.
They are very delicious. But when you're
not in the South, you need to get down here and get you some Bojangles chicken biscuit. I'm telling you.
But when you're starving, Bojangles is pure torture.
But not on Fridays for, you right. know, just over a month more.
Yeah.
Then you can go get you a fillet of fish at Mickey D's.
There you go.
Yeah. Or it's that's
probably better. Yes, I'm also in the unfortunate situation of being a Catholic who doesn't really like seafood almost at all. So my Fridays during Lent tend to involve peanut butter and jellies and macaroni and cheese.
Oh boy.
So
hey, peanut butter is like a staple in my normal diet. So,
yeah, for me, me and my wife both, we have a tendency to Netflix and chill, like actually chill, you know, on the couch and veg. We decided to give up like movies and TV shows and all that secular stuff. And really, it's just a good practice to limit your consumption. Those things are full of so much garbage.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, it's. I'm glad there are some lead on you know literature and comic books at least. I'm glad some people are you know actually making a move to you know take back real cultural ground that has been almost entirely surrendered. But it's yeah, television and movies like finding a television show not specifically not like explicitly aimed at Christians mm-hmm. that doesn't you know egregiously insult you within like three episodes is pretty difficult these yeah. days.
Yeah, no doubt about that. So good, very good. And you know, since I've been Catholic, I've always found that God seems to coalesce things in my life right as Lent starts to bring things up that I really don't know. Would that be even like asking him to or it's sort of like I don't know what things in the forefront that I should address during Lent, which is really neat. I don't know if you had the same experience. Good. Well, I guess we can get into some news articles here or blog posts. I wanted to let you all know, listeners, we started a listeners group on Facebook. So if you are a regular listener of Men with Chess, I encourage you to Men with Chess listeners group. You can search that. We'll add you. And we're having it's a closed group, so you can speak freely. You don't have to worry about what your Protestant grandmother thinks about what you're saying or anything like that. And we're having already, just opened it yesterday, we're having a rousing discussion about monarchy. Is it good? Is it bad? Will it work? Are other forms of government better? I don't know. Come into the group and find out. But I do want to cover this blog post from the Mad Monarchist. It says, when does Republican magic work? Right? So the gist of the article is that the liberal democratic Republican model makes great claims for itself. It is the enlightened government from the Enlightenment, the product of Enlightenment philosophy and ideas. It makes great claims for itself. It's sort of the end of history, Francis Fukuyama, we defeated the socialists. We are the best mankind has ever devised. But the Mad Monarchist points out here that liberal Republicans in France and Italy and Germany that existed collapsed and ended in chaos and revolution. The Weimar Republic led to Nazi Germany. But Canada, Latin America, and all these other countries. He says, however, if all else fails, liberals can always point to the one country that mesmerizes people all over the world, the one which both her friends and foes take the center of all life on the planet. That is the old USA. Even in America bashing Europe, the liberals almost invariably point to the United States and to the founding fathers of America as a great success story and the example for others to follow. Yet, the liberals of the left liberals and the left liberals in particular cannot seem to get their stories straight. On the one hand, they think America is so wonderful and so superior to other countries in the world that it is positively cruel and inhumane to expect people to live anywhere else. Certainly see that. While on the other hand, being the ones most eager to provide skeptics like myself with the longest list of American failures or to respond to the likes of President Trump with the assertion that America was never great. So that's the first thing I want to point out. That there's this thing, dichotomy, that liberals, as he puts it, has regarding the USA. Did you have any thoughts about that, gents?
Coming from a purely moral perspective, generally republics tend to be some of the most morally bankrupt forms of government we have. All we have to do is look around at society around us today to see the product of that, of bringing the individual up in the social structure to the point where the individual is the most important thing there is. And what that does is that it accentuates one of the seven deadly sins, that being greed. So we have people exploiting other people for money, for sex, for all their own carnal pleasures, and it's led to a society that's geared to cater to this.
Interesting. Sean? Are you there?
Well, there's also the thing that, like, within the idea of, you know, a democracy or a republic, there's an enormous, you know, area, an enormous variance that can all be labeled that. And, you know, some people would argue that before the 19th, wait, ah, crud. The in the United States, the, you know, basic political unit was not the individual, but the family as a whole. And, you know, because, you know, the father of the family was, you know, considered to be, you know, voting on his family's behalf, and you know, if you look at political changes since that time, on the whole, it's, you know, it's not been a very positive shift, you know, since that time. There, you know, most of the things that traditional Christians, you know, decry in, you know, American society are relatively recent, or, you know, recent century, and, you know, pretty much since, you know, that one change. So the idea of a liberal democracy carries a lot of, I mean, there's a lot of variation in there, and there's a lot of options for, you know, where that can go.
Very good. Well, for me, we've talked a lot about liberalism, and this is a part of it. It's the air we breathe. It's the water we swim in 21st century America. All of our movies about utopian futures portray, you know, Republican democracies as being the ideal form of government. Sci-fi movies, enlightened planets and societies that exist all have, interestingly enough, strikingly similar forms of government to our own. I don't know if you remember Guardians of the Galaxy, that planet they had to save at the end. And it was all this like beautiful, colorful, multicultural utopia Republican democracy, as an example. Oh, Star Trek, I think, is a fascist dictatorship. But that's a different story. But anyway, that's my take on it. But really, I think the money quote on this blog is the last paragraph in which he says, the bottom line is this. If liberalism is supposed to be all about the power of the people and allowing the people to do exactly as they please, why are so many people in even the most successful of liberal democracies so constantly unhappy and discontented? The answer, as should be all too obvious for now, given recent events in both Europe and America, is that the people are not actually ruling themselves. They never have done and doubtless never will. They're being ruled, but not in an open and honest way. And this means that they're being manipulated by those who are their rulers, but do not wish to be seen as such. This, I think, is something no traditional monarch has or could ever be accused of doing. For them, such a thing would have been unseemly as well as unnecessary, but in the liberal system of idealism, it must be done to maintain the charade. To keep hiding the truth that liberalism is just as totalitarian as every other political ism that has ever been devised. So that to me rings very true. And this is part of the reason why I started to think more in a monarchical sense, is because I realized that the people don't actually have the power in a democracy system. Instead, they are duped by the mass media, by the school system, by the government propaganda that's put out, to think that they have sovereignty and power, but it's not true. There is a group of extremely wealthy oligarchs behind the scenes that rule things with their pocket. They buy off politicians, they buy off judges, and they exercise their will through soft power behind the scenes in the shadows. And personally, I'd prefer to see who's actually ruling over me. If I'm going to have either a king or a group of oligarchs, I would prefer the king, because at least I can see his face. And if he steps out of line, maybe I can get a mob together and take some torches to his palace. I'm just kidding. But you can't really do that with oligarchs. You don't know whose palace to go torch, unless you do research. But who's willing to do that? You know, we're too busy Netflixing and chill. So,
yeah. The thing about a system that's built off the basis of human greed is that there will always be someone wanting more. And when people describe democracies, they try to push this idea of, you know, like you said, the people ruling themselves, and we vote for who we want to lead us. But in our reality, I mean, and I think people are waking up to this fact, we may vote in this guy or that guy, and he may make this promises and that promise. But in the end, it's whoever has the most money that will decide policy. It's whoever's willing to pay the most. Everybody's in it for themselves. And yes, you may get that one oddball here and there who's actually a decent politician and actually fights for his people and what his people want. But those are so few and far between, they often get shut down by the majority. And it's a sad reality, but it's the reality that we live with. And so we have this shadow government behind the scenes, you know, pulling the strings with dollar bills.
Indeed. And I do have a interview with Jay Dyer coming up in the second hour, and we actually get into discussing who this oligarchy is, what their agenda is, what they're driven by, what they're trying to do, and the impact that they've had on the 20th century and 21st century in dismantling traditional Christian Western civilization. So it'll be a fascinating talk, a little conspiratorial, but you know me. Sean, did you have anything on this one? Any more?
Well, I don't know. It's the other thing is, like, if you had a monarchy, I mean, at the same time, just because you have someone who is, like, you know, who has the title of king, at the same time, there's also, you know, still politics of all kinds going. There are people, you know, jockeying for control. And so I definitely understand democracy tend to democracy. You know, we're seeing that very much in the United States and the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom voted to leave the European Union, you know, popular referendum, you know, clear vote. And is it ever going to happen? Well, the government doesn't want it to happen. And it's, you know, starting to look very questionable whether it ever will. So, you know, the people can have a vote and the people, you know, in government will still get what they want. And, you know, in the United States, the people voted for have this, you know, entrenched bureaucracy and appointed judges who are basically doing everything they can to undo, you know, anything he tries to move, which, you know, very much to his credit, he is still making progress and he is still getting things done, but it's very there are a lot of, you know, people in power who, you know, the will of the majority is, and are just moving things to get what they want.
Yeah. Hey, real quick. And would you mind, your connection's kind of in and out. Would you mind maybe jumping out and jumping back in, see if that fixes it?
Okay. Yeah, I'll hang up and call back in one moment.
Awesome. Thanks. So, yeah, I mean, I think he makes a good point, Sean. You know, I'm by no means saying, and I doubt the mad monarchist believes that monarchies were without their corruption and their scheming oligarchs behind the scenes. John, are you there?
I'm here. Is this sounding better so far?
It is.
Sounds much better, actually.
Okay. Good. All right. Good. But, you know, it's very clear, you know, you know, as advertised. And then the question is, you know, like, as, you know, when you're especially a good question to bring up when you're arguing with, you know, a leftist and they're saying, well, such and such needs to stop and it's not working at all. And then you say, well, okay, as compared with what? You know, right. We need to get rid of the Second Amendment and okay, as compared with what? What would be better? And it could, I'm not saying that a monarchy wouldn't, it's just, I don't know what the evidence works out to. I mean, you can certainly look at the Bible and you can see, you know, it's almost, you know, every time it's alternating, you know, in the history of Israel, good king who, you know, follows God's commands, who, you know, leads the people well, bad king who leads people into idolatry, causes all kind of problems, and, you know, God sends a plague. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you know, the monarchy of Israel definitely had a checkered track record. As I was saying, though, when you left the chat and came back, that I don't think the Mad Monarchist or myself or really anyone else who thinks about monarchy is saying that monarchs and their time and power are not without corruption and oligarchs scheming behind the scenes or anything like that. The difference, though, is with a king or a queen, possibly, you're not having them run for public office. You're not having them have to win over a majority of the people to be in power. So they don't ever have to campaign and get donor money to fund all these commercials and things. So when you have people who constantly need to be elected every 4 to 8 years, that's when these oligarchs really get their claws in there, because they can donate millions and millions of dollars to their candidate and choice, say, I'll fund your campaign, I'll help you get elected, I own all these media companies and newspapers and da da da, if you exercise my will on this issue against the interests of your constituents. Historically, not every king did this perfectly, but historically, monarchs have been a check against oligarchs. When oligarchs amassed too much power, because they didn't have an interest in getting elected, they could just come out against the oligarchs, and sometimes they would kick them out of the country. Sometimes they would arrest them and have them killed. So, you know, wouldn't it be great if we had a king in America and he, you know, kicked George Soros out of the country or put him in a supermax prison or something, as a well-known oligarch, as an example? But that's what I would say is the response.
This is something
I realize this is tangential to your example.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I realize this is tangential to your example, but where does George Soros actually live? I don't know.
Oh, he is from hell.
No, not where is he from? Where does he reside?
I don't know. I think Europe or something. I know he's from Hungary. Okay. Hungarian Jewish person. He was alive during World War II. So
if I recall correctly, Hungary as a country is not terribly fond of him.
No. So I would imagine he lives in Europe somewhere, some chalet in the Alps or something. I don't know.
In response to what you're just saying about, you know, it's the old argument. So, of, well, what if we get a bad king? What's stopping him from ruining the entire country? And that's something. That's why I harp so much on the correcting the natural order. When things are ordered correctly, then, especially in this day and age, when we have the church that Christ founded. The church acts as a check for the monarch. If the monarch doesn't rule according to the will of the church, which in a correctly ordered society would be also the will of God, then they fall out of favor with the church and thus fall out of favor with the rest of the monarchs, causing, mm-hmm. Huge political disadvantages for them. So being in favor with the church is politically advantageous for the monarch, so thus provides motivation for the monarch to rule benevolently.
What was that quote by Charles Coulomb? I'll probably butcher it, but I'd rather be ruled by an unelected king who's afraid he'll go to hell if he does a bad job than by an elected president who doesn't.
Well, and, you know, there's also the issue of the religious and moral character of society at large. Of the options he gave, I would probably, choose an unelected king as well. But there is also the option of, you know, there is at least in theory the option of an elected government, which, you know, is Christian, is, you know, composed of Christians. And, you know, at that point, it's on us to, it would be on the people to, you know, to create that government. But what was, and the other, I had something and it's gone.
Gentlemen, real quick, I want to announce that we are up to two.
Okay. Yeah, I lost that.
Hello, viewers. How are you? let me see if I can pull up the chats. Maybe you guys are commenting or asking questions. But yeah, to your point, Sean, that, wait, what was your point?
I was just saying that, like you know, oh, options of a serially king.
Yeah. You were saying that republics who are made up of good character Christian people could theoretically have a good Christian society. Is that basically the gist of what you're saying?
Well, that's part of it. And also have the other, you know, possibility of a king who is, you know, not a Christian, a king who is not religious and holds, you know, no respect for God's law. And that seems, you know, roughly the same. Seems that it would have roughly the same outcome as what we have today.
Yeah, that's fair point. To what you were saying, though, I would respond that the United States of America, while not a Catholic nation when it was founded, the vast majority of people who lived in this country when it was founded were people who had much more traditional Christian morals, and they had a democracy. But because we didn't have that historical check on the oligarchy, they were able to get their tentacles into things and corrupt the morals of our nation via the courts, via the education system, via the mass media, all these things that they use. And it would not have been as easy as it was if we had had someone with the power to extrajudicially smash them.
And I realized this was something I wanted to bring up earlier, and I'm kind of... I guess I am the at least slightly more inclined to democracy of the three of us. I'm the closest to a defense attorney there is, but I guess I'm testifying against my clients because there is you know, definitely one negative feature of elected democracies, and that is the politicians, you know, the governing politicians have there's no incentive for them to look ahead of, you know, the next election cycle. There's no incentive for them to look farther down the road and say, oh, this policy might be popular, you know, right now and get me votes next November, but it's going to cause, you know, enormous problems at X point down the road. Well, at X point down the road, they're already out of office and or dead. And then all of our children, you know, $50,000 in debt or whatever it is at this point, you know. Right. And so that is definitely a bug in the system, that there's no capacity for long-term planning.
And let me just say that I do agree with you wholeheartedly that a republic filled with good Christian men who honor God with their decisions and their decision making would make a great government. We see good examples of that in the Republic of Florence in Italy. It was a very good society. The reason I go with a when I put a Christian republic up against a Christian monarchy, even though they both would accomplish the same goals, the reason I choose monarchy over republic is because it more closely resembles the model that God has set forth for us. Because as Christians, we acknowledge Christ as our king. And I believe that our earthly government should seek to mimic that as closely as possible.
No, that's definitely one of my preferred arguments for monarchy as well. Yeah.
I definitely see the attraction of that. At the same time, like that feels a little bit like some people today, say, well, we should get rid of the idea of some Christians today say, well, we should get rid of the idea of, borders and nation states, and we should all blend together because, like, if you look in Revelations, it says, he will, people from every tribe and tongue and every nation will, be joined together in worship of God. And it's like, well, yeah, it says that at the end, but, like, how has trying to, create the end state of Revelation, the end state of, God's paradise here on earth worked in the past? Hasn't tended to work very well. And so it's not exactly the same, but I see some similarities with that kind of argument.
Well, two things about that argument is we're talking about a perfected society there where nobody sins, everybody is in a perfected state, and so everybody lives together harmoniously. There's no one trying to kill anybody else, nobody trying to impose Sharia law, nobody trying to kill your children. That's one thing to it. I know you pointed that out. The second thing is what does everybody in that scenario have in common? They're all citizens of the kingdom. They're all card-carrying citizens of the kingdom of God. And that's something I think we can look at is, when we have these people advocating for the mass invasion of undocumented migrants, it just doesn't work out. But we're getting off on a rabbit trail, I believe.
A little bit, yes.
I was going to say, it's funny because the interview I mentioned, Jay Dyer actually brought that same verse up from Revelation about the many tribes and tongues and all that, talking about how it must be noticed that the distinction between the different peoples were still there at the end. Mm-hmm. So God did not intend for us to become a big, giant, mixed-up, multicultural gray glob, right? God created the different people groups that exist all over the world, and it's a part of the beauty and the true diversity of his creation. He doesn't want those distinctions to be destroyed. So
wait, you're saying God is not John Lennon?
No, he is not. Thankfully.
Oof. Oh Lord.
That song, I tell you, it's the most obnoxious song. Just take the Communist Manifesto and turn it into a horrible pop song.
I will have to send that. That reminds me. I don't know if you'll want it up on the page because it's a little harsh, but I will have to send you a meme I made probably at least a year ago involving that song. If you like it, feel free to put it on the Facebook page. But I'll have to hold on to that and send that off.
Yeah, definitely send it to me. Let's move on to the next topic. Gentlemen, it has been said, anything worth doing is worth doing right. Would you agree with that?
Oh, of course.
Yes. So, something that's more worth doing than anything else? I would go with the Holy Spirit of the Mass, or rather, attending Mass, worshiping in Mass. So, to put on my stodgy old man hat, I want to get into a discussion about proper reverence during Mass. I go to a Novus Ordo parish full of baby boomers and older folks. Hey, are you wearing a fedora?
It's my stodgy old man hat.
Perfect. And frankly, these are great people, but there's a lot of lax behavior in Mass these days that I've noticed. So we want to get into a little discussion about helpful tips from the men with chests on how to exercise proper reverence during the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass. So, Let's see here. Number one on the list. Well, this is in no particular order here. And gentlemen, if you have anything more to add on this list, feel free. But number one, enter the sanctuary with a prayerful spirit of reverence. You know, don't come in there like it's Cracker Barrel or like it's a Southern Baptist church that's social club. This is where Christ is made present, truly, and manifest in the bread and the wine. This is a house of worship, truthfully worship, not a house of chit-chatting and laughing and socializing. People are in there trying to pray and ready their hearts and their souls to receive their Lord. And they don't want to hear about what your Aunt Susie did last night and yada, yada, yada. So that's first and second tip. Enter with a spirit of prayerful reverence and don't chit-chat with your buddy. Gentlemen, you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I would say that I'm totally in agreement with you here. That when we enter Mass, no matter where it is, we should enter with a prayerful reverence and a respectful quietness. I think a big thing with this is something I'm a little bit passionate about is architecture. When you walk into a modern looking church, it seems more permissible to, you know, talk to your buddy next to you. It doesn't seem like it doesn't seem as much like a holy place. And so it inclines people more to be more lax when they walk in. When you walk into older churches that have the pictures of saints on the walls and beautiful architecture, and it invites more of a spirit of reverence. That's one thing. And second, that really isn't an excuse. It's just observation from my point. But whenever we walk into any Catholic church, regardless of the architecture, we should have that spirit of prayerful reverence, and we should definitely encourage our friends and family and fellow parishioners to do the same.
Well, for me personally, this is the idea of the general attitude is relatively easy to. It's relatively easy to stick to, you know, quiet and respectful, because I'm in the habit of going to confession immediately before Mass. Mm. And at, you know, if you're assuming you take it seriously, there's, you know, not a lot that's going to, you know, make you more respectful and, you know, serious about the matter than having to sit down, you know, with the priest and say, okay, I failed here again.
Yeah.
And one of those. And I hope God can help me get this sorted out. Right. And which it's so that's always been, you know, that's been pretty helpful for me.
That's a good tip. Really good tip. If your parish offers confession just before Mass, go. That will certainly help with your spirit of reverence.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to the next one here. Silence your phone or just leave it in the car so you don't look at it during Mass. This is on my Ash Wednesday service that I went to. There were a lot of people there, I think, who don't normally go to Mass. That happens a lot on Ash Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And three different cell phones went off during Mass, one of them during the priest blessing the host. And that was it was a very old man, and he had this look of pain on his face when it went off, like, his toad and turned it off. So I felt a kind of sympathy for him, you know, because he probably just forgot. But I just leave mine in the car. And I think if you can't go an hour without your cell phone, then you probably have a problem. So that's a good indicator. But I mean, you always have your cell phone on you. Facebook's always at your fingertips. Just setting it aside for an hour is an act of a small act of sacrifice, I'd say. And your ringer is not going to go off during mass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and most of the time I do the same thing, just leave it in the car. Sometimes, of course, I forget it's in my pocket, but then I always make sure it's silenced. But yeah, it's definitely a good point of practice for anyone attending the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass. Is just turn it off, leave it in the car. You don't need it. You're with Jesus. You're with the King of Kings. You don't need to know what Aunt Sally's having for lunch that afternoon.
Yeah, not during Mass. You don't need to really know that ever, unless you're Sally's dietitian or something, which you're probably not.
Or possibly going over to Aunt Sally's and you want to see if you have to bring your own food or not.
So yeah, that's a pretty easy and straightforward one. I assume, Sean, you agree with it.
Yeah, I mean, nothing. It's pretty obvious. Nothing really to add.
Yeah. Number four. This is kind of maybe a controversial one. Probably not among our listeners, but don't hold hands during the Our Father. This is not something we're supposed to do with the laity. As the laity, we're basically performing a function that is the priest's to perform. When the Our Father is going on, you just pray. Keep your eyes closed. Just pray along with him. Holding hands is called the Orans posture, and it is for the priest to perform, not the laity. I don't know, James, you had some more specific information on this that you wanted to add.
Well, specifically on the laity taking the Orans posture during the Our Father, the argument for it is that the general instructions for the Roman Missal doesn't make any specifications on what the laity is supposed to or not supposed to do here. So they take that as freedom to interpret as they see fit. But what it does specify, that while the priest takes the Orans posture, if there is a deacon assisting, they are not supposed to. It specifies that specifically. And so it ends up with this awkward situation where you have the priest in the Orans posture and you have the deacon not in the Orans posture. Then you have all the laity in the Orans posture as well. It doesn't balance out well. And then
we are an incarnational church. We worship both with our soul and our bodies. This is the way God created us. We're hylomorphic beings, so this stuff doesn't matter. I'll just read a little bit from this blog, Catholic 365, on this topic. Just to give you a little background. September 3rd, 1958, the Sacred Congregation for Rites issued a document called De Musica Sacra et Sacra Liturgia, or the Instruction on Sacred Music and Sacred Liturgy. The document stated, since the Pater Noster is a fitting and ancient prayer of preparation for the communion, that's the Our Father, the entire congregation may recite this prayer in unison with the priest in low masses, so basically the Novus Ordo Mass, and the Amen at the end is to be said by all. It was at this time that the faithful were given permission to pray the Our Father with the priest. However, the faithful maintained the same posture as before, standing with their hands folded in prayer. Prior to this instruction, the priest prayed the Our Father on behalf of the faithful. The Orans posture, hands out like that, is representative of praying on behalf of others. The next time you are at Mass, watch the priest gestures closely. Anytime he offers prayers on behalf of the faithful, he uses the Orans posture. Anytime he is offering other prayers, his hands are folded together. Having a better understanding of what particular gestures mean will lead to a better understanding of the liturgy. So, don't do this. That's for the priest. Just do a little humble prayer like this. And, you know, practice. John, did you have anything on that?
I think you pointed to that article several months ago. That was the first I had heard of any distinction on this one. So, you know, I'm a relatively recent Catholic, and this is not like I haven't you know, made a lot of study of the, you know, liturgical forms and, you know, the specifics of the ritual. So, you know, my habit was to do what the people around me were doing. And so,
Standable.
You know, at most people, you know, most people did hold their hands out. So I was like, okay, well, this is what I'm supposed to do.
Right. And you're not alone in that. I mean,
and so, you know, even people who are raised in the church, that's what they're going to do. You know, children who grow up Catholic, you know, they're going to see what their parents do and follow that. So,
yeah. And really, honestly, it's really on the priests and the bishops to catechize the laity on what's proper. And a lot of them just don't. So, you know, it's up to the laity to inform themselves oftentimes. Mm-hmm. I wish they would just make a statement from, you know, from the lecture. You know, hey, guys, this is what you're supposed to do, not this. It would take a minute, but they probably just don't want to hear about it.
Well, I've only been in the Catholic world for about 2 years now, but my limited experience, what I've seen is you have two situations where this stuff goes on. Yeah, one situation you have the priests that either don't care about this sort of stuff or promote this sort of stuff. And then you have the priests who do care about it, but the churches nowadays are so run dominated by lay politics that the priest is afraid to make a push on it. Because yeah. you have Knights of Columbus councils and the women's councils and these groups of laity coming together who seem to really actually be calling the shots for a particular parish, where in olden days it was more the priest's responsibility.
Indeed. So yeah, that's the skinny on the Oran's posture. So if you were holding hands before, you know, I understand that's what a lot of people do, especially in the South, as James was saying. So don't feel bad, just correct it, and I promise you'll feel much more reverent when you just hold your hands in a quiet way. And if someone reaches out for your hand, you know, don't be rude to them, but try to behave in a way that's a good example.
Just tase them.
That's fine.
Normally what I do is I fold my hands and I bow my head, and normally that's enough to keep them from trying to reach for my hand, because they already see that my hands are otherwise occupied.
Exactly.
And then you have also a reason for ignoring them because your eyes are closed.
The Our Father is not about community, you know, it's about worshiping God. So you don't need to focus on your neighbors and all that stuff. You're the focus of your soul and your mind should be on your Father. See, Our Father. So, let's see here. Let's try to move through this list. I navigated away from the page for some reason. Hang on 1 second. Next one that I had was this. The second. It was. Oh, so this is not a hard and fast rule. This is just a friendly suggestion for increased reverence of the consecrated host. When you go up to receive the host, just take it on the tongue while kneeling. This is literally the God who created the universe right in front of you. And the priest in persona Christi or in the person of Christ, is presenting it to you. So I don't know about you, but my hands have not always been up to good, right? I've sinned, you know? So this is not dogma or doctrine, but it feels much more reverent when you kneel before your Lord, you allow the priest in persona Christi, whose hands have been consecrated for this work, place the host on your tongue. And this is the way Catholics received the host centuries and centuries before the 20th century. So while the church allows you to receive it on the hand, acceptable, I would offer that it is not the most reverent way you could receive the Lord. Go with the other way. And I tell you what, if you do that, you're probably going to inspire others to reverence as well.
Coming from a convert's perspective, I am anxiously awaiting Easter when me and my wife will both be confirmed into the Catholic Church and I'll be able to receive the precious body for the first time. And at this point, I've been thinking about it, and I do not think that I can physically stand while receiving it. Like, I don't think I can do that. And which is going to be fairly interesting because everyone at my church receives standing. Yeah. And I don't think I can do that and feel right about it. When I get there and I'm about to receive, I don't know if I'll be able to help myself, but other than fall to my knees in front of my Lord, my Savior, and my King. It's just, sure. It's something I've been struggling with, and I think it's something I'm going to have to talk to my priest about, because it will be abnormal.
I mean, you'll definitely stick out. I mean, I stick out every Sunday at my parish. I've gotten used to it now, but, you know, it's just...
Have you had any others join you?
Yeah, a few people, but, I mean... It's a kind of an older parish, and the people have been there forever, and they've been doing the same thing the same way forever. So it's like, I don't think they're ready to just start changing things up. But, I mean, they haven't, like, given me dirty looks or said anything about it. So it's like, it's fine. You get used to it. Sean, did you have any thoughts on this?
I, you know, again, coming in relatively recently, and when I, you know, I adopt the practices around me, and so I had always, you know, as the rest had, I had, you know, taken the hand. I, you know, because of the way it's done at our church, I actually kneeling, I think, would seem disruptive and, like, you know, perhaps deliberately calling attention to myself. So I don't know if I would do that, but it would feel odd, but I could certainly start, you know, taking communion on the tongue rather than in the hand. And, yeah. I'll have to definitely give that serious consideration. And I guess, yeah. You know, no better time to start than, you know, during Lent.
Right. Yeah. And this is for people who take it on the hand. And that's what they feel is the right way to go for them. The church allows that. So I'm not trying to condemn or anything like that, or make it seem like I'm more holy than you. This is just a helpful tip from your friendly host here to help increase your sense of reverence during Mass. And I think it develops a connection to all the Catholics who have come and gone before you, because, as I said, this was the way the Catholics host for centuries and centuries, and it wasn't changed until after, you know, the whole Spirit of Vatican II revolution swept the church. So
one thing I want to say on this, bouncing off what you said, you can take communion reverently in the hand. What I get angry about is when I see, you know, people, they go up there and they put their hands out like you're just grabbing it from the priest and going along your merry way. I believe it was Saint Augustine who had this quote about turning your hands into a throne for the king of the universe. And it, when it comes down to it, whether receiving in the hand or receiving on the tongue, receiving while kneeling, receiving while standing, have your mind right. Have your mind in the right place. And that's the biggest thing I have to harp on. Understand what you're doing. You're taking part in something that connects you with every other Catholic in the entire world by receiving the body of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And not only is it connecting you to every Catholic in the world at this point, it's connecting you to every Catholic that has been or ever will be. Because, so just remember that when you go and you receive communion, whether you receive on the tongue or receive in the hand, know that you're receiving the King of the universe. And the only reason that you are able to have a hope of going to heaven and living forever in the love of Christ.
Good. Well, let's finish this list up here. The hour is closing in. We've got two more. This one is rather until after the final song or until after the priest blesses the crucifix. That one's just self-explanatory. It's a sign of respect
for the
Mass, that you're not just ducking out as soon as you can. If you stay in and worship to the end with the rest of the laity and wait until the priest and the deacon have left the altar and exited, that's a great sign of respect. In addition, we'll just finish this last one. Women who may be listening or men who have wives or girlfriends, try recommending that your wife veil, wear a chapel veil at Mass or while in prayer. I bought my wife a chapel veil for, I believe it was our anniversary last year, and she loves it. Sometimes she forgets to bring it, but when she does, she loves wearing it. And she's a modern woman, strong, independent. Her mom was a feminist type of woman, so she was raised in that culture. But I tell you what, if you just recommend certain things as a husband or a boyfriend, women are very willing to take that submissive posture in these things because that's how God created them. So I think for women at Mass, the chapel veil will definitely increase the spirit of reverence. Do you have anything, James?
As I'm not a woman, I don't have a lot to say.
I agree with you on all of that. The veiling at Mass is simply a sign of respect. The same thing as everything that we've been talking about. That. It's just showing your reverence to the Savior. I mean, I think that's the biggest thing is people forget who we're celebrating with, who were there, who's there among us when we gather. Everybody's been kind of got this whole idea of, you know, this buddy Jesus who's everybody's friend and, you know, your secret confidant and things like that. And he is all those things. And it's great. But at the same time, he's also a king and is worthy of everything that comes with that. So remembering to have a sense of respect and honor when you come before his body is something that is incredibly important when you go to Mass.
Absolutely. And also, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and the other thing, and this is, you know, a part of the job of parents and a part of the job of, you know, the catechizers and, you know, even the priest. I don't think it's made sufficiently clear, you know, a lot of the time, even the people who have been in the church you know, their entire lives, like, you know, what is actually going on here and what, you know, we're dealing with, and that, you know, God himself is physically present here with us. And, you know, if people don't come in with that basic understanding, then, you know, pretty much everything else is going to go wrong. You know, there's if you don't have that idea coming in, like, you can't fix anything else because that's the center of it. And so, you know, I think that emphasis, like, making clear, you know, the meaning of the, you know, the idea of the real presence, that, you know, Jesus, you know, that Jesus is here. And, you know, he is deliberately making himself here for your sake, you know, for your salvation. And, yeah, I think that's just a, you know, part, one thing that, you know, can be emphasized, can be taught and emphasized much more clearly.
Very good. And that's
definitely something we as laity can help with as well, when in discussions with our friends and fellow parishioners, that we make sure to encourage that sense of the true presence of Christ. Because if Christ isn't there, you know, what are we doing other than, you know, gathering for a social club? Why not talk to your buddy before Mass, before the priest gets up there and starts yapping at us? Why not just take the host and stick it in your mouth and chew it up and go along your way? Why not duck out as soon as the important parts are over? Because if Christ is there, why not? Or if Christ isn't there, why not? But if we remember that Christ is there, then these things should start coming naturally.
Very good indeed. Yeah, I don't think I can put it better myself. So thank you, gentlemen, for tuning in. That was a good discussion. And stay tuned for the interview with Jay Dyer coming up here. Y'all have a wonderful evening.
God be with you.
God be with you.
And God be with you. This next clip is from the HBO series The Young Pope. It is about a young conservative American prelate who becomes a pope and revolutionizes the church in a more, I guess you could say, traditional way. The series itself, as I understand, I have not watched, is full of some scandal. However, this scene in which he addresses his cardinals in the Sistine Chapel is just delightful. So enjoy.
Knock, knock. Knock, knock. We're not in. Brother cardinals, from this day forward, we're not in, no matter who's knocking on our door. We're in, but only for God. From this day forward, everything that was wide open is going to be closed. Evangelization. We've already done it. Ecumenicalism. Been there, done that. Tolerance. Doesn't live here anymore. It's been evicted. It vacated the house for the new tenant, who has diametrically opposite tastes in decorating. We've been reaching out to others for years now. It's time to stop. We're not going anywhere. We are here because what are we? We are cement, and cement doesn't move. We are cement without windows, so we don't look to the outside world. Only the church possesses the charisma of truth, said Saint Ignatius of Antioch, and he was right. We have no reason to look out. Instead, look over there. What do you see? That's the door. The only way in. Small and extremely uncomfortable. And anyone wants to know us has to find out how to get through that door. Brother cardinals, we need to go back to being prohibited, inaccessible, and mysterious. That's the only way we will once again become desirable. That's the only way great love stories are born. And I don't want any more part-time believers. I want great love stories. I want fanatics for God. Because fanaticism is love. Everything else is strictly a surrogate, and it stays outside the church. With the attitudes of the last papacy, the church won for itself great expressions of fondness from the masses. It became popular. Isn't that wonderful? You might be thinking, we received plenty of esteem and lots of friendship. I have no idea what to do with the friendship of the whole wide world. What I want is absolute love and total devotion to God. Could that mean a church only for the few? That's a hypothesis. And a hypothesis isn't the same as reality. But even this hypothesis isn't so scandalous. I say, better to have a few that are reliable than have a great many that are distractible and indifferent. The public squares have been jam-packed, but the hearts have been emptied of God. You can't measure love with numbers. You can only measure it in terms of intensity. In terms of blind loyalty to the imperative. Fix that word firmly in your souls. Imperative. From this day forth, that's what the Pope wants. That's what the Church wants. That's what God wants. Once. And so the liturgy will no longer be a social engagement. It will become hard work. And sin will no longer be forgiven at will. I don't expect any applause from you. There will be no expression of thanks in this chapel. None from me and none from you. Courtesy and good manners are not the business of men of God. What I do expect is that you will do what I've told you to do. There is nothing outside your obedience to Pius XIII. Nothing except hell. A hell you may know nothing about. But I do. Because I built it. Right behind that door. Hell. These past few days, I've had to build hell for you. That's why I come to you belatedly. I know you will obey. Because you've already figured out that this Pope isn't afraid to lose the faithful if they've been even slightly unfaithful. And that means this Pope does not negotiate on anything or with anyone. And this Pope cannot be blackmailed. From this day forth, the word compromise has been banished from the vocabulary. I just deleted it. And Jesus willingly mounted the cross. He was not making compromises. Neither am I. Amen.
Again, that was from the HBO series, The Young Pope. The Pope is played by Jude Law, and his papal name is Pope Pius XIII. Stay tuned for the interview with Jay Dyer, Looking Under Satan's Hood. Enjoy.
Jay Dyer, thanks for coming on Men with Chess. Really appreciate it. How you doing tonight?
Doing well. Busy time. A lot of the debates going on, trying to organize a lot of stuff, trying to finish my second book. But I'm glad to be here. I'm honored.
Excellent. Yeah, I heard you have a big debate coming up tonight on Worski Live with an unnamed big YouTuber. Is that right?
Well, I haven't heard back yet from Andy. I heard from him a week ago, and he said he would try to get it arranged tonight. But I texted him today, and he hasn't responded yet, so I don't know.
Oh, wow.
It'll be tonight for sure, but it keeps getting postponed, so hopefully it'll happen eventually.
Gotcha. All right, well, I hope that goes through. I look forward to listening to it.
Me too, man. I'm excited to debate. Mega big atheist, and I think some people have already figured out who it is. It's not Stefan. It's not Styx. It's not Jordan Peterson, so that only leaves a handful of other.
Well, I was kind of hoping you were going to do a seance and debate Christopher Hitchens.
Actually, I'm not trying to be offensive to this person, but I don't think he's not really known as being an intellectual atheist. He's more of just a vocal, kind of a flamboyant atheist, more so than a PhD or something.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I look forward to it. I heard your debate with Nicholas Fuentes, and I thought that was very entertaining, and so I respect your debate skills, that's for sure.
Well, thank you. I've yet to lose a debate, actually.
All right. Well, for those of you who don't know, Jay Dyer's website is jaysanalysis.com. He's the author of Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Film. Jay, what else do you want us to know about you?
Yeah, I am the... I run Jay's Analysis, as you said, but I also do a subscription service there. That's kind of the main means of how people interact with my work is through the articles and the videos and subscribing to educational content, basically. So there's a lot of lectures on philosophy, history, theology, geopolitics, book reviews. And I've been doing that for, I guess, about a year and a half or 2 years now. So that's one way to access my material, and I also am the co-creator and co-presenter of the television show Hollywood Decoded on Gaia TV, which is accessible through Xfinity and Amazon Prime and all that stuff.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, I watched that episode you sent to me on Lord of the Rings. It's fascinating stuff. I thought that was really great. Kind of a cult or symbolic Siskel and Ebert, I guess you could say.
Yeah, we try to say Siskel and Ebert on acid or Siskel and Ebert 2.0 or different ways to kind of update Siskel and Ebert. But thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem. Well, good stuff, man. I appreciate it. We wanted to talk tonight about social engineering. I've heard you talk about this competently in the past on Tim Kelly's show and other places, and specifically how it's affected Christianity in the West in the 20th century, but also more broadly. So I think hating on baby boomers is kind of a popular meme right now, and there seems to be kind of something wrong with them. They're very self-indulgent people, and they kind of, you know, wasted away our economy and all these different criticisms we have. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of that has to do with the social engineering that's gone on. So can you give us kind of a big picture, where is this coming from and why is it being done?
Yes, and I have to take some credit for that because my friend Mark and I were writing blog pieces about 8 years ago making boomer jokes. So I might, me and Mark might actually be the first internet boomer posters. But anyway, yeah, I mean, it's obviously not anything as naive as to say that the problems of the world are the result of a single generation. We have to look, I would say, at many years of practicing and perfecting the technique of social engineering. So in a very broad sense, this is the practice that goes all the way back to Machiavelli, or you could extend it back even to ancient empires. And you even see this kind of stuff in the Bible. You'll see means and methods of geopolitical machinations when you read the books of the Kings, Chronicles, Samuel, etc. But in the modern era, it's a little more precise because you have the rise of technological process, techne, and scientific technique in how to manage mass groups of people. Mm-hmm. So you I would argue that most of this arises out of the military and wartime strategies and planning. Certainly prior to that, you had bankers who were already back in the 1700s, 1800s, the times of the revolutions. They had already noticed how to fund revolutionary movements in other countries. This is not solely the enterprise of Jewish bankers. It is a practice of bankers in general. And you can read Carol Quigley. I have lectures on the totality of his book, Tragedy and Hope. And he covers he uses France as one example. And he covers the Rothschild, the Catholic, and the Protestant interests that all were sort of vying for power and control of France as one test case. Now, certainly over time, Jewish banking interests tended to have a lot of power through the Rothschilds, but we can't leave out our WASP and our Vatican bank connections either. And of course, the Rothschilds have also been the official papal bankers, I think, since the 1700s. So all of these interests interconnect. And as I think Spengler put it very well, there's never been a socialist revolution that wasn't funded by capitalists at the top. And I think that that's accurate. And so when we look at the French Revolution, we see a kind of a combination of Protestant, Swiss, and Jewish banking interests and the British Empire having a vested interest in removing a Catholic monarch. We see a similar pattern with the funding of the Bolshevik revolutions from the Warburgs and other New York banking houses. And that was essentially to reconstruct and set up a social experiment in Russia to get rid of the idea of a czar, an imperium, and a confessional state. So you see the same pattern of the removal of the Holy Roman Empire in Europe and the removal of the Byzantine continuation in the Romanovs, their removal by the Bolsheviks. And ultimately, this, I would say, is at the behest of the money power. It was the banking interest behind both of these things. Quigley comes to the same conclusion that Friedman of Stratfor came to when they both said that the 20th century was about the Atlanticist or Western power bloc's removal of their two main rivals, namely Germany, Austro-Hungarian Empire, and Russia. Mm-hmm. So that's the 20th century in total in both of the wars and the Cold War. But what you get out of these wars and the wartime experience is a lot of research and development that goes into the war machine and perfecting the techniques of war. Quigley, for example, was a maritime war historian. So he also has other works about histories of civilization and warfare and so forth like that. Hold on a second. Excuse me. So this research and development was focused largely in the traditional sense of psychological warfare, but also in the implementation of new techniques and strategies that would involve a lot of advanced things like cybernetics. This would come to dominate entities like DARPA, which would be very instrumental in how to manipulate technology to achieve the upper hand in warfare. Specifically things like mimicking nature, transhumanism, et cetera, et cetera. But specific entities that can definitely be pointed to would be the Tavistock Institute, the Frankfurt School, the which, by the way, both had intimate connections to the CIA, the OSS. And as I was discussing Habermas in one of my lectures last night for subscribers, Habermas is one of the premier figures of the Frankfurt School, which was the German Jewish figures who had studied culture and the idea of culture critique, culture creation, and ultimately culture degradation. And so Habermas, for example, talks about how you could socially engineer America through all of these different cultural means. And what most people don't know, however, is that it was the OSS, the CIA, the Rockefellers and Macy Foundation money that actually brought these Eastern Bloc Marxists over to help America fight the great wars. So what you get in America is basically they mastered the art of culture creation and toxic culture. And so it's not just Jewish interests. It was Rockefellers and the CIA that brought the Frankfurt School people over. So there was a combination of interests there. It wasn't just one group. They both had a vested interest. And so that's how we get the 60s counterculture and the boomers is from these, I would say, Pentagon, military, CIA, Frankfurt School characters are all on the same team.
Yeah, there does seem to be a real tendency these days on the internet among alt-rightish type communities to point the finger at Jewish interests and ignore some of the other interests. But there definitely was a lot of different groups working together for the same goal. But I'm kind of curious, is there a unifying ideology for this agenda, or is it just about amassing power and money, or what have you found out?
Well, I think that people who don't have a theology or a belief in the transcendent, they're generally walking around in a hall of mirrors trying to figure out who the one bad guy is. But if you have a conception of theology and a belief in the Bible, things like this, then you tend to have an overriding view of history in total, beginning, middle, and end. And so you have a conception of good and evil. Mm-hmm. And so good and evil are, of course, spiritual forces, and they are not any specific racial, ethnic, socio-political group or class. That's not class warfare. It's not any of that. There are undoubtedly powerful interests, but I see the Rockefellers as far more powerful and influential and prominent in the last century than Jewish interests, for example. I mean, the Frankfurt School would not have had any power had they not been brought over by the British intelligence and the CIA and the Rockefellers.
Indeed. Yeah, I've heard you talk about on other shows how in America and to some degree in Europe, the right wing tends to always point the finger at Marxism and communism. And this is the reason our civilization's been undermined and gender identity destroyed and pornography pushed on us. It's because some sort of KGB psyop or something. But in reality, when you look at it, it really seems like this is coming from, as you said, the big banks, because they really funded these revolutions, and the Rockefeller interest also pushed these things here at home. So really there's a lot more to it than just commies, right?
Absolutely. This is very crucial, and this is one of the main reasons why I did the 8 lectures on tragedy and hope, is because Carol Quigley, who himself was a Catholic of sorts, or professing Catholic of some kind, was very much a fan of the Western Atlanticist democratic order, and he actually thought that, you know, this democratic New World Order would be the best thing for the world. So that's why he was a true believer and a supporter, I believe. And Quigley is very adamant in the book. This is probably what the book is most known for, is the quotes where he says that the communist, Marxist, leftist, socialist movements in America on their own had absolutely no power and weren't that effective until they received all of this money from these very wealthy elites that were both Jewish, Protestant, and at times even Catholic. So, I mean, it might be difficult for some people to wrap their head around that, but I mean, it's like I said earlier, that this is why you have the Wall Street funding both Nazis and the Bolsheviks. And one of the best ways to see this is to read some of the real inner circle planners of this whole system, this overriding ideology that you asked about. Yes.
Right.
I've been doing a series called Globalist Books, and this is characters like people from the CIA, like Miles Copeland, or people from the Royal Society, like Bertrand Russell, the Fabian Society, people like H.G. Wells, and they are very, people like Charles Galton Darwin, Arthur Kessler. I'll be doing Jacques Attali next. These are characters who are very open about the overriding ideology, and it's not solely racial. It is also materialistic. It is technocratic and dysgenic. And so that's what Bertrand Russell says. Russell says, yes, I'm very happy to see the Bolsheviks succeed in Russia because he says it's a social experiment, just like all the other 20th century movements and ideas. He says they're social experiments to see which things work best for the technocracy.
So the end game here is the development of this New World Order type technocracy, I guess is what you could say. It almost, to me, looking at it, seems like kind of a like a dark alchemy or something, like a social alchemy. They're melting down all these social institutions that we've had in the West for centuries and trying to create an entirely new society that's almost an opposite image of what was there before out of what they've melted down. You know what I mean?
I think you're spot on. There is a chapter in Tragedy and Hope that a lot of people miss because everybody focuses on the sections where he talks about the bankers funding the communists. There's a more important chapter about the rise of the military industrial complex. And Quigley's whole point in that chapter is that the New World Order is transhumanism. It is technocracy. He says that's the whole goal of all of it. So we can argue about all these other things, and I'm not saying you can't argue about those other things. I'm saying that the long-term plan is not just Israeli. It includes the Saudis. It includes, you know, China. It includes all these other interests to be a part of this global scheme. You can debate to what degree, atheistic Zionists or whatever have a role in that, but I think that the overarching plan is technocracy. It's not rooted in any kind of Jewish messianic claims. You know, do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, yes.
I don't think that Bill Gates, David Rockefeller, and these people who have, you know, arguably some of they're probably some of the most powerful men on the planet. I don't think they're really concerned about Jewish messianism. I don't think they care about Palestine.
Right.
So what do they care about? Technocracy. And so I see the most powerful people all being on board with that. And that's why to be in that kind of club, you have to be on board with that. They don't really care about the ideology of a single, you know, piece of land in the Middle East. I'm not saying that Israel doesn't have a role in that. But if you look at when Israel was being set up, what the Balfour Declaration and the Royal Society and all this, what they were saying at that time, they weren't really concerned with Jews or Arabs. They just wanted an outpost. And the Royal Society who set that up were just as interested in controlling the Islamic world as they were at controlling the Jewish homeland.
Hmm.
This is why, by the way, Jews got mad at British occupation, and you had like the Irgun and the bombing of the King David Hotel and so forth.
Right. And they do seem to have these technocrats, an apocalyptic prophet in Ray Kurzweil. And he published that over a decade ago, talking about the year 2045 and how human beings will become just totally integrated with computer technology and AI, and the planet Earth will basically become like a technological god being, you know. But I don't think that this is the plan for all 7.5 billion people. I think the becoming transcendent technological god beings is for the upper class, and the rest of us will. Well, I'm not sure what they have planned for the rest of us. Do you have any ideas?
Well, yeah, they say very clearly to get rid of everybody else. So there's no debate about that. That's been that when you read all of these globalist texts, and these are formative thinkers for the global plan, they always talk about two or three things across the board. They never disagree about Darwinian evolution and technocracy. They never disagree about the crisis to kill off most of the planet. And they never disagree about the implementation of a federation of all nations into a global government. Every one of them always across the board, that's their dogma.
Hmm.
So one example, another good example, this is somebody like Arthur Koestler. Now, a lot of people would say, well, see, Arthur Koestler in 13th Tribe proves the Khazarian theory. Well, I don't really put a lot of stock in the Khazar theory. I think it's kind of a silly thing, but what's interesting about Koestler himself is that he stepped out of caring about Jewish interests and was self-consciously a Luciferian. And he was part of that inner British Royal Society clique. And he wrote Ghost in the Machine. And at the end of Ghost in the Machine, he says what you just said. He says, it is a dark alchemy, what we're doing to the globe. And it is he puts it, the way he states it is to commandeer evolution, to propel the species to godhood, basically, is the whole point. So they're all agreed on transhumanism. That's who came up with all this. The Huxleys, you know, coined the term transhumanism. That is the ultimate goal. And that's also why you see a convergence of people, somebody like Ray Kurzweil, who I would assume has some kind of Jewish background, and David Rockefeller. Right? They both like the idea of transhumanism because it's an alternate version of the gospel, right? Salvation through technology. And so you could look at it like, who's the bad guy? Well, in the first century, who was the bad guy? Well, you had the Pharisees. They teamed up with Caesar and Herod. Yeah. So there's a combination of interests that are in rebellion against truth, against Christ, against the Logos.
Right.
And I don't believe that they actually will achieve technological godhood. I think that's partly a lie, a myth that they are projecting. And certainly there will be technological enhancements, probably extended life, longevity. You know, I'm sure there will be all kinds of new miraculous nanotech health discoveries, but to think that this is going to give you immortality, I think would just be utter stupidity and being completely naive.
Yeah, no, I totally
agree with that. Why would the people who say that they want you dead give you immortality? It's utter stupid.
Yeah. No, I definitely think it's an overreach, that whole what is it called? The Ray Kurzweil theory? I forget, but I don't think it'll get that far to a technological godhood. But, you know, all this technology...
Singularity.
Yes. I think it's a positive thing in and of itself, and we just need to reconvert the culture and baptize it.
Exactly. Yeah, I was... I forget which talk or stream or something, but I was saying that we have the template, you know, already laid down as to how to build societies, how to build cultures, and how to have real progress. And I, one of the things that I always cut at the root of is that most Jews and most alt-right and most atheists and most pagans, can you think of one thing they all have in common?
No, not off the top of my head. What was that?
Darwinism. Yeah. So I'm a big opponent of Darwinism and have been for a long time. I'm always trying to find somebody to debate it.
Yeah.
And I've written a whole ton of articles, against Darwinism, and Darwinism factors directly into transhumanism. Darwinism, I believe, I come at it from the position of a philosopher. That's my training, and so I critique it from a philosophical standpoint, which is not to say that I don't ever engage in the scientific discourse. I do, but I'm mainly concerned with higher order questions, and philosophy is a little bit higher order than empirical science. So I believe that Darwinism is a mythology that originally comes from ancient Hinduism, and so the people want to make a connection between like scientism and Kabbalism. Yeah, you can find that connection because ultimately these positions are really the same as like ancient perennial tradition style Hindu stuff. So you were once a rock and then you were once a goo and then you evolved into, you know, to something else. And so the transmutation of species, I think, which is completely ridiculous, is really a very powerful presupposition that most people aren't willing to criticize or question. So that's why I think the alt-right is doomed to fail, as well as all these movements, because they're all predicated on a false grand mythology, which is basically, you know, if you read the ancient Greek myths, it's the same idea. It's like lightning. The gods struck the ground with lightning and, you know, out of it comes man. I mean, that's like exactly what the theory of the rise of the protozoa was. So
you're telling me, Jay, that you don't believe that all the complexity of life evolved from a single cell organism? You don't think this is a scientific fact?
No, because as I understand, DNA only prints what it has within that species code. So a whale is never going to print bear code. Right? A tree is never going to print whale code. You can have mutations and adaptations, but the new coding that is expressed to show those mutations or adaptations is only what is already present in the strand, and it's either on or off. Hmm. So the whale never has bear code.
Well, I tend to agree with you. I've been skeptical of evolution and Darwinism my entire adult life, being raised in a very conservative evangelical home. That's sort of par for the course. But it's really when you look at it and take yourself out of the conditioning we've been put through, the social engineering we've been talking about, it's such an absurd theory, and there's no way you could empirically prove it. You'd have to right. go back in time billions of years and then observe the species evolving and have right. some sort of billions of years of immortality to even prove that it happens. So it's just an absurd thing on its face. And it's funny because of the reaction you get when you say you don't believe it. They treat you like you're the absurd person. So it's classic projection, I'd say.
Right. And this is, there's many reasons for this. But most people who, for example, go to university and study biology, or they study astronomy. And when I was doing my undergrad, I mean, I had to take science classes. I took a lot of philosophy science classes. I interacted with all of these different professors and people with, you know, getting a biochemistry degree or whatever. So I did this for many years, and then I did grad school. I'm not unfamiliar with what is taught and how people defend their positions. And what I did when I was in my undergrad was actually pretty consistently debate professors. That didn't make me very popular with the professors, but I did it, and it is what it is. And so for most of the science professors that I had, for example, there was one guy who was an astronomy teacher, and I had a debate with him, and he actually suggested that I debate the head of the department. So I went to the head of, I can't remember, he might have been the physics head, it might have been a different guy, but I think he was a physics guy. So I had a long, long, long debate with the head of the physics department. And what I came to realize, I was like 23 at the time, so I wasn't super versed in everything, but I did understand basic apologetics, and I understood basic presuppositional apologetics at the time, so I was fairly well armed. And I realized that education is compartmentalized, and the people who study physics, they don't know philosophy. That doesn't mean that every person who studies physics doesn't know philosophy, but on the whole, it's very compartmentalized. If you are getting a PhD in physics, you might have only had one or two philosophy classes. I mean, it's not required. You might have had logic, and you maybe, if you wanted to, you might have taken something like, you know, philosophy 101 or something. So most of them don't study a whole other discipline called philosophy of science, which is very famous, has a lot of great intellectual giants who've written on the topics, people like Michael Polanyi. And he's a famous scholar who has critiqued the positivist empiricist tradition of the physical sciences and philosophy of science, which is a dead end. But you will be very hard pressed to find many people who get, quote, hard science degrees who don't grasp this. Now, this is another interesting point that should be made, is that there's a distinction between life sciences and hard sciences.
Okay.
And so things like biology, I'm not saying that they can't involve aspects of hard science, but when they start talking about the theory of origins, it's very speculative. Okay. If you're an engineer, which is part of science, engineering is science, computer science, mathematics, right? You're engaging in something that's more, I would say, directly relevant to something like understanding DNA, because you understand design and you understand architecture, right? And so a lot of times when propagandists for Darwinism start talking about science is all on our side, science is all on our side, that's not actually true, because there are plenty of engineers who are theists and who recognize all of these same principles, and they're part of science. So it's just kind of a game they play where they kind of move the markers around and they move the delineators around to decide who's part of science and who isn't. And it's all relative depending on the debate at hand. So, so they just don't know what they're talking about. I mean, I rambled there for like 5 minutes. Forgive me.
No, that's fine.
But at the end of the day, they don't know the basic philosophical questions, like, you know, what about the principle of induction? You know, you ask most philosophers and, I mean, scientists, unless they've studied a little philosophy, they're kind of like, what?
Yeah.
What about this idea of do you believe the future will be like the past? Oh, well, that's just kind of a basic assumption. We don't worry with those questions anymore. So they'll arbitrarily kind of just throw out the things that they don't consider relevant. But there's no clear scientific test for what things are objectively relevant or not. It's their subjective taste. And this is why you have people like Neil deGrasse Tyson will say a philosophy and philosophy of science don't matter anymore. Well, they don't matter because he can't answer those questions and he gets mad when people ask them.
Right. Yeah, I've noticed that, especially in the new atheist community, there was a big attack on philosophy in general, classic philosophy, yes, because right, they were bad at it, basically.
Right. All they do is, you know, it's funny, they will criticize theists, and I will give them some credit because a lot of theists make bad arguments and they rehash bad classical proofs for God, which I don't think are very good. I think they need to be kind of restated because the questions and needs of our time are not the same questions and needs of, you know, the year 1300. Hmm. So they'll throw this monkey poo at the theists quite often and say how bad their arguments are and that they just rehash old debunked arguments. But guess what? All these new atheists are just rehashing people like David Hume and people from the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not doing anything spectacular either, but rehashing, you know, Enlightenment era arguments. So
yeah, absolutely.
I think that the discourse is pretty low level and pretty lame and pretty weak, and it's kind of that way by design. I mean, a lot of these people are really just kind of pop figures propped up, like Bill Nye. Bill Nye's changed. Bill Nye's been caught contradicting himself multiple times. Somebody put together a great video of Richard Dawkins totally contradicting himself within a few years about junk DNA, where he's like, junk DNA proves evolution. And then like a few years later, when suddenly they've decided maybe there's not junk DNA, he's like, I've never said junk DNA proves evolution. The fact that there's no junk DNA proves evolution.
Yeah, well, these guys are definitely propped up in one way or another. I mean, for the public consciousness, science is not, you know, the scientific method and empiricism. It's just a way to drive the narrative in a certain direction in favor of Darwinism, in favor of transgenderism, all right, these social issues. It's just another form of social engineering. So
Absolutely. That's
why you have all these scandals at the different scientific journals. People will contribute studies that have bad evidence in it, specifically to see if it can get published, and it does because it supports a certain political narrative they want to push.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of articles that you can pull up about fraud in science, fraud in the peer review process. There's no actual peer review way to prove the peer review process. I'm serious. Yeah. And there've been countless mainstream articles on this. The most famous of which people can look up is the Lancet Journal, which I've sourced this so many times. I need to just archive this on my website, actually, but everybody should read the very brief discussion from The Lancet about where they were discussing about 50% of most peer-reviewed papers are fake.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and The Lancet is, of course, Oxford's premier longest-running medical science journal.
Hmm. That's insane.
That was published, I think, 2 years ago. And you can still pull it up. The PDF of the actual file is still available, at least it was fairly recently. So, and this is not anything surprising or new. Now, people will hear this and they'll say, oh, you're a science denier. Not at all. I mean, in fact, as I said, you know, a lot of my graduate work was philosophy of science, was phenomenology, was the questions of analytics and how analytical philosophy ties into, you know, the hard realities of the here and the now, right? This is kind of ancient philosophical questions just rehashed in modernity. So I'm very pro-science. I think science is a wonderful tool for understanding the natural world. And anybody who would deny that is a complete idiot. But science as a tool is a giant light year leap from scientism, which is a grand narrative explanation.
Yeah.
But no tool can ever be a grand narrative, right? If you have a monkey wrench and a giant, if you have a monkey wrench, the monkey wrench doesn't tell you how a car is built, right? I mean,
right.
A wrench is a tool. It doesn't give you an explanation. So in the same way, the scientific method is a tool for understanding the natural world, but by its very nature, it's not designed to ask questions that by definition would come outside the scope of empirical investigation. So for example, mathematical concepts, logical laws, these by definition are abstract. And so they are not material. So when the so-called scientist or scientism proponent propaganda says, I don't believe in anything immaterial abstract that I can't see, he's not being honest, because he will absolutely utilize mathematical concepts, principles, ideas like law, ideas like rights, and those cannot be empirically demonstrated or proven.
Very good. Well, let's shift topic back to the I want to talk a little bit more about the baby boomers and kind of what specifically was done to them as a part of this social engineering agenda. You're probably familiar with Terence McKenna, definitely a spook mouthpiece, well, maybe definitely, talking about the archaic revival during his career. It kind of seems like there was an agenda to dismantle the industrialized civilization that had been created in America and kind of get people to go back to the land and start living in, like, small huts and communes and kind of go back to an almost feudal lifestyle. Would you agree with that, or?
I would absolutely agree with that. And I just put up a documentary at my website called The Net, which is about MK Ultra and the Unabomber and the rise of the internet. And this is an old, somewhat famous documentary from, I think, 2000, 2003, somewhere in there. And this is an interview with a lot of people who were formative in the rise of the internet. And this is, you know, people at DARPA, people at MIT, military, Pentagon level people. And they are discussing the simultaneous rise of the concept of the internet in the 60s with the Cultural Revolution. And so what I'm getting at is that the deeper that you dive into this question, when you read the works of Dave McGowan, you find out that absolutely the counterculture, and this would include the archaic revival, primitivism and this idea, but all the hippie ideas, and Terence McKenna, obviously, as part of that giant social engineering project. And I don't think there's any question about that anymore, the deeper that you dive into it. A lot of people, the boomers especially, have not heard this or not familiar with it. And so they kind of saw themselves as, you know, positioned in this period of Cold War, where Russians are all the bad guys and it's, you know, the evil empire. And the only way out of that is to make sure that Americanism and Pepsi and Coke can be spread to the whole world, right? And simultaneous with that is what you're saying. The deindustrialization is absolutely aided by the rise of the hippie culture. And the same people at the Royal Society who back in the 30s were talking about the deindustrialization of the West and the rise of China as an industrial powerhouse for the globe. Oh, wow. They were also the people who were saying we can socially engineer the West with giant LSD, mushroom, Terence McKenna, Timothy Leary, Stooges.
Wow. And this was back in the 30s.
Right. So in the 30s, you have Russell saying, and I did two talks on Bertrand Russell's books, Scientific Outlook and Impact of Science on Society. And in both of those books, he discusses the geopolitical plans and how the West will attempt to be destroyed and deindustrialized and the rise of the East. And he even mentions things like mass weaponized migration.
Oh, wow.
And this, at the same time, another one of his cohorts in this conspiracy, Aldous Huxley, was instrumental in Tavistock and the British version of the rise of LSD, Sandoz Pharmaceuticals. And that's how the CIA would, because the CIA is working in tandem with British intelligence. And so they are the ones who are coordinated with Tavistock to, you know, share research and so forth. And they realized that, yes, everything that, that Huxley's talking about, that's, this is why Huxley went to Berkeley and gave his famous lecture. Berkeley, hello.
Right. Right.
This is hippie central. Saying that you will be given giant loads of drugs and you will be ushered into the technocracy. That's what he says in the lecture. And he says, even says at one point, all you people in the audience are too stupid to even understand that I'm telling you that this is really going to happen.
Wow. Yeah. And, you know, he was right. I mean, most of the people in the West have no idea what's happening to them.
And he's also not a good guy warning us. This is another mistake. No. A lot of people make a mistake and they say, oh, but when I read Aldous Huxley, he talks about freedom and he doesn't want us to be enslaved. That's because he's a liar. That's because he also wrote elsewhere that he believed in this plan.
Yeah. So how did this impact this shift to deindustrialize and the hippie movement and all this? How did this impact Christianity in the West after the hippies started to rise up? I heard you talking about this recently. I was wondering if you could give us a little insight here.
Well, you have the co-opting of the church, basically. Yeah. And even though this Habermas talk that I did last night was for subscribers, it was actually illustrative in one part where he talks about the churches being made Marxist. Now, let's put this in context, because in a sense they were and in a sense they weren't. If you mean by Marxist the Frankfurt School Marxists and the cultural degradation, cultural Marxism,
yeah,
they have been turned to that. But how was that done? Was it done by a bunch of dirty dudes on the streets of Haight-Ashbury with Che Guevara t-shirts and wearing a beret? No. It was done by giant hordes of money behind the Frankfurt School, as one example. It was done with giant amounts of money put into studying the effects of LSD by the military, by the CIA, by psychiatric institutions. It was done by the promotion of the degenerate rock bands, right? So this changed the culture, and because American Christianity, American Christianity from the beginning, I would say, has been very troubled and kind of on a double think dilemma because of the weaknesses, I would say, in the founding ideology of America. Mm-hmm. There's always been a susceptibility in American Christianity to, instead of informing the culture, to mirror the culture. So it should be the other way around. But, you know, this is why your preachers in America end up looking like CEOs, they begin acting like CEOs, and their churches look like giant strip malls or factories.
And that's the heresy of Americanism.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think Wim Hof is correct that the CIA, through the facade of the Cold War, I'm not saying there weren't real persecutions during the Cold War. In fact, this actually duped a lot of the Russian immigrants, the white Russians that left Russia. It was British intelligence and people in the West that brought them over. But I don't think that they understood that the long-term game was not that the people in the West were their friends. The long-term game was to ultimately, support the dismantling of Russia and the institution of the New World Order. And the CIA did a similar tactic with the Catholic Church by getting the Catholic Church to jump on board the CIA's doctrinal warfare program of C.D. Jackson and other characters like that, Henry Luce, and that this ended up being part of the reason why Vatican II happened, and you had the passing of the acceptance of Dignitatis Humanae and Nostra Aetate.
Hmm. And just for the listeners out there, not all my listeners are Catholic, but most of them are. Jay is not Catholic. He's Orthodox. So just so you're aware of that. And, you know, we don't have to agree on every single thing, but look into these things because there definitely has been deep state influence on the Catholic Church. There's no denying that.
Well, David Wim Hof is a practicing Catholic, as I understand, and he does accept Vatican II. So I'm just using him as an objective Catholic source who.
Sure.
Who, as a lawyer in this giant, you know, thousand source paged book, you know, he argues, I would say definitively, and it actually makes a lot of sense with all the other research that isn't Catholic. You know, I mean, Dave McGowan is not Catholic, but was not Catholic. He's passed away, but, you know, his book was not focused on religion, but it kind of came to the same conclusions that you had the deep state basically interested in trying to co-opt large religious institutions, and you will find that this is very common. And just think about it from the deep state perspective. Wouldn't you want to use the engine of something like Catholicism for your purpose? Yeah, I mean, Brzezinski in Between Two Ages, he says in the first few chapters of the book that that America and Americanism has to capture and use these big institutions like the Catholic Church.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and this is probably the most conspiratorial type interview that I've done on this show. I've said often, though, that I believe the people who are in control of our civilization right now are very evil. And this is just opening up the Pandora's box to look at the kind of evil that they're doing. These people are diabolical geniuses. And this is the war between good and evil, which is why it's so important for Christians to stay in prayer, to study philosophy and good, solid theology, and to not be taken in by this stuff. Because when you fully grasp the amount of conditioning that you've been put through in your life growing up in the second half of the 20th century and the 21st century, you have to go back to first principles and reevaluate all your assumptions about the world. So and that's a little closing thought, I guess.
Well, one other thing I would say to Catholics, and I formerly was Catholic, is that there are plenty of Catholic books that will vindicate what I'm saying. The most obvious of which are the papal encyclicals of the last couple centuries. And I'm not saying read all of them, but if anybody does want to delve into that, I would recommend a couple things. I would say read first and foremost Leo XIII's encyclical, Humanum Genus, on Freemasonry.
Mm.
Then I would say read the Tan books, the Tan publisher book, The Popes Against the Modern Errors. And then if you read those two things, you'll see that, you know, this is not a crackpot conspiracy theory, but something that the papacy has been talking about for a long time. In fact, there's a whole slew of anti-Masonic papal encyclicals.
Yeah, that honestly, that kind of thing was really what got me interested in Catholicism, was seeing how the popes and the church were really at odds with this evil agenda early in the 20th century. And I'm sad to say that it's lost a lot of ground in the second half, but anyway, those encyclicals are definitely eye-opening, to be sure. We need to do a show on Freemasonry sometime and their battle with the Catholic Church. That would be interesting.
Yeah, it would be. I've also been reading Occult Renaissance Church of Rome, which is a critique of the Renaissance era papacy by Michael Hoffman. And I think he makes a very compelling case. I think he's very weak when he tries to explain the first millennium of the church. But I think for the second millennium of the church, he also makes a very interesting case that it's not like everything was rosy, you know, prior to the French Revolution.
Right.
There was a lot of the same kinds of hermetic, Gnostic, Platonic, and Kabbalistic influence prior to, the modern Enlightenment period as well.
Yeah. And I was saying on the last show that this kind of worldview we've been talking about is a sort of form of Gnosticism. And really, Gnosticism's been around since the first century of the church. It's waxed and waned in its influence and presence, but really, when you start to think that you can use your willpower and technology to override the laws of God and the natural law he's written into reality, that is a form of Gnosticism, trying to escape physical reality. And anyway, so that would be my thought on it.
I would totally agree. And I was just having a discussion with some people today about this. We were kind of arguing about the question of race, ethnicity, gender, these kinds of things. And when you believe in the goodness of God as a creator, which Gnostics don't, when you do believe that God is a good creator, you suddenly don't have as much of a problem with there being other ethnicities, other races, and different genders. That real diversity is not an issue for you. You're not worried about it. And for Orthodox, you know, we have our tradition of iconography being done a certain way. Always, you can't like make up some kind of new way to do icons. And that's because we believe that they don't just show us a window into heaven, but iconography also confirms the veracity and truth of history. So if there's a saint like Saint Moses the Black, who was a famous black man who's a saint, you know, he in his icon, he's going to retain his physical characteristics and his race and his gender. And, you know, in the book of Revelation, when John sees into heaven, when he sees the eternal state, he says he sees every race, tribe, tongue, and ethnicity present. And that's because, of course, Christ died for all. There's no question about that. But Christ dying for all does not mean that he wipes out people's history and ethnicity any more than it means he wipes out gender. So that's why it's very important for us that you don't, you know, Jesus, think about Jesus when he's resurrected. He doesn't become pan-gender, pan-racial Jesus. He becomes a no longer subject to death. Well, technically speaking, he wasn't subject to death, but he willingly underwent death. You know
sure,
what I'm saying?
Sure, sure.
In his resurrected state, it's still the same Jesus because he has the hole in his side. Thomas puts his fingers in.
Right.
And he says, you know, he says that we will be like him. We'll have the same type of resurrection, which does not negate our historical existence and who we were.
Sure. So if you're a black Christian, you die and you're resurrected, you're going to still be a black resurrected Christian, right?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the thing about Babel and the New World Order, globalism, transhumanism, it is Babel. You know, they say we want to make a tower to heaven in our own name, right? And that's contrasted with Abraham, who builds an altar to the Lord and calls on the name of the Lord.
Right.
So Abraham's religion is based around theology and faith first. And Babel, worldly religion, the city of man, as Augustine called it, is based around the idea of man will be God. And that's what transhumanism is. It's just a repeating of that. And Babel is still manifesting today in globalism. Mm-hmm. Babel is the idea of wrecking all the different cultures and nations and tribes into one giant blob run by Skynet.
Yeah. And that is what's going on in Europe with the Muslim invasion and the United States. Right. And even in China, they're trying to do this in every country that has a national monoculture. They're trying to turn it into the New World Order, corporatist, gray glob. So
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally agree.
All right. Well, Jay Dyer, thanks for coming on. That was a great chat. Hope to have you back soon to talk about some more theological issues, if that's amenable to you.
Sure. Anytime.
All right. Well, I sure appreciate it, man. God be with you.
All right. And I would add, too, that if people are interested, my book is still available. And if you would like to get a copy of it, please get it from me and not Amazon, because Amazon undercuts authors. My book is not an occult book. It is a comparative religion analysis of different movies and films in 363 pages with 404 footnotes. And it includes very subtle critiques of things like Darwinism and atheism under the guise of film analysis.
Yeah, I'm kind of still kind of new at the podcast game, so I forgot the plug section. I also wanted to say, if you go into Podcast Addict and search Jay Dyer, you'll get Jay's Analysis RSS feed on there and get all his great content. He's been putting out some awesome stuff lately. Maybe you have another method they can find that feed as well.
It should be on all the major feeds like that. Okay. It's on Spreaker and it's on iTunes, and you know, you can always go to YouTube. My stuff goes out to all those areas.
Good deal. All right, man. Well, thanks again, and you have a good evening.
All right, thank you.
Peace.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you made it this far, I truly appreciate that. Don't forget to check out our website, menwithchess.site, menwithchess.site. You can get the RSS feed link there. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Subscribe to us on Stitcher. Definitely give us good reviews if you like the show and get our numbers up and our ratings up on all those formats there. Also, if you feel like you could write a good blog post that would, you know, fit our content here, we'll publish it on our website for you and promote you on our social media. So definitely do that. Thanks again. We'll see you next week. And of course, Deus Vult. Pergam fortium mundo divina vetrute, in infernum detrude. Amen.
Defende nos in prelio, contra nequitiam et insidias diaboli est obbe signum. Imperit ili Deus, subices de pecamur, tuque princeps militiae celestis, Satanam aliusque spiritus malignos, qui ad perditionem animarum, pervagantur in mundo divina vetrute, in infernum detrude. Amen.